Well, David, I like the pictures of that chubby 13-year-old, too. Well, happy Father's Day, and in recognition of Father's Day, I want to look at some of the character qualities listed in Psalm 15. So turn over to Psalm 15. I had thought about doing a sermon that I was going to title Toxic Masculinity for a Complete Politically Incorrect Sermon. But I think I'm going to wait till next year because I want to develop this whole idea that real men get in a pit with a lion on a snowy day and take it out. That was one of David's mighty men. And there's a whole list of these guys that are just like, that's a little beyond me. So I need a year to gear up for that. So instead, we're going to look at Psalm 15. These are excellent qualities. Really, it should be developed by everybody, but I'm going to be addressing primarily the men. But let me quickly remind you, ladies, that you have a great influence upon the men in your lives. So you need to pay a close attention as well. Encourage the men in your lives, whether it be a husband or your father or your sons, to develop these particular qualities. And for you single ladies that are interested in finding a husband, I would say Psalm 15 is the equivalent of Proverbs 31. We often look to Proverbs 31 as these are the character qualities of a godly woman, and so ladies, that's what you're working at developing. And I tell the guys, that's the kind of woman you want to find. Find one that has these qualities. For you ladies, Psalm 15 is the equivalent. This is the kind of guy you want to find. Okay? So guys, if you want a good woman for a wife, make sure you develop these qualities because that's what she's looking for. I'll begin by reading through the psalm and give a little background on it, and then we'll examine the meaning of each stanza, and I'll point out some examples of specific men who exhibited these characteristics. It's both my desire to explain and motivate you. Press on and develop these characteristics of godliness in your own life. Psalm 15. O Lord, who may abide in thy tent? Who may dwell on thy holy hill? He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. He does not slander with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend. In whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. He does not put out his money at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. He who does these things will never be shaken. Now, this is a psalm of David and probably written about the time the Ark of the Covenant was moved to Jerusalem. That's recorded in 2 Samuel 6. Psalm 24 is a companion psalm, very similar in content. It opens with two questions of qualification that are then answered in four stanzas that each give three answers to the qualification questions. So it begins with these questions. O Lord, who may abide in thy tent? Who may dwell on your holy hill? Now both of those questions are addressing the same subject. The answer to those questions are very important because that is what is going to qualify you to really to be in God's presence. These are the qualities of those who will worship God truthfully. And it's these questions that indicate to us it's probably written about the time the ark is moved to Jerusalem. Now, perhaps David is concerned that the worship of God is going to denigrate in the future into just mere ritual. And so the psalm would be certainly an excellent reminder of what true worship is and that it's best seen in the character of those who are coming to worship him. The very quest to give proper honor to God demands humility on our part as we bow before our Creator. And therefore, we're encouraged by that to develop the qualities of godliness. But probably more to the point here, these are the natural questions that are going to be generated by David's first attempt to move the ark to Jerusalem. It was a failed attempt because they were not doing it God's way. They did it their own way. Now, we recognize in 2 Samuel 6, there's a fellow named Uzzah who is killed because of his actions. And we recognize that it would be good on Uzzah's part to want to take part in moving the ark up to Jerusalem. But neither he nor the others were following what God said about moving the ark. In fact, Exodus 25:14, Numbers 4:14 are very specific on how the ark was to be moved. Only the Levites, who were descendants of Kohath, were allowed to carry the ark on its poles. And only the priests, who were descendants of Aaron, could touch the ark in preparing it to be moved. And so we recognize a good motive on Uzzah's part, as they had loaded it on an ox cart, and as they're going along, it hits a bump, it gets jostled, and he wants to protect the ark. And so he reaches out to touch the ark, and he's struck dead immediately. Actually, it's God's mercy that only Uzzah was struck dead. Every single person there was guilty of irreverence toward God. If you think about it for just a moment, Uzzah thinks he can protect God, because that's really what he's trying to do. We understand that, but yet an irreverence because they didn't do it God's way to begin with. God's work must be done in God's way. And so the natural question is going to arise as David finally gets the ark into Jerusalem. Who is qualified to be in the presence of this God? This one who is so holy, so righteous, how do you approach him in the proper reverence? And so the psalm would be something that was going to spark that question, be sung to the congregation, and motivate them toward what they should be like and what they should do. Now, the point of the question is not who may live in your tent and set up residence on your holy hill. The words for abide and dwell here are more temporary in nature. Might translate them a little better to get that idea as sojourn or stay. Although at the same time, we need to recognize those who sojourn with God, those who are qualified to stay with him temporarily on his holy hill, are also those that will be qualified to spend eternity with him. We might rephrase David's question of God here as, O Lord, who is qualified to come to you? Who will you accept when he comes to your house? Who may come to worship you? Now, the answer to the psalm may seem a little surprising in comparison to many other passages of Scripture, because the usual answer has something to do with spiritual issues, faith, belief, the heart, things like that. This psalm sets forth qualifications in very practical terms. And there is good reason for that, for Jesus said in Matthew 12 that the mouth reveals the heart, and James chapter 2 makes it clear it is the works of a person that reveals what they believe, what their faith is. So though the qualifications of the psalm set forth practical actions, the underlying understanding is these are the things that are being generated out of the heart. This is what the person believes. This is what the person is acting upon because it's in their heart. Now, verse 2, the first description of this man, three general characteristics. He walks with integrity, he works righteousness, his word is truthful from the heart. First, he walks in integrity. The King James here has walketh uprightly. Good way of putting it. The word is a broad word. It has a wide range of meanings. But the central idea, this is someone who has moral conduct and is steadfast in that moral conduct. He is a person who is decent, moral, honest, honorable, respectable. And so the King James uprightly is a good description. C.H. Spurgeon commented on this. It's like a man walking a tightrope. He stands straight up. He does not sway in either direction or he's going to fall. So he's walking upright. Now this particular word is used only of three people in the Scriptures, David, Noah, and Job. In the case of Noah, it had become a unique quality among men. In Genesis 6:5, it describes mankind at that time as so wicked that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And so Noah is the complete contrast to that. He's described in verse 9 as a righteous man, and that's that particular word. Blameless in his time, Noah walked with God. The godly man has integrity. He would walk uprightly with God regardless of what anyone else around him is doing, often in spite of what those around him are doing. That's certainly politically incorrect in our time, isn't it? Because the pressure is for you to join the crowd, and walking with God is against the direction of the crowd in our lifetime at this point. Second, he works righteousness. Now, this is, of course, the natural outgrowth of walking integrity, because such a man is going to work righteousness with his conduct, proving his character. Okay? What you do arises out of who you are. This man's faith is alive. He puts it into practice. As James 2:17 states, faith, if it has no works, is dead, being by itself. Salvation by God's grace through faith, which is something that God gives you, that's Ephesians 2:8-9, it's not of works, but verse 10 adds, but we are his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them. So again, your conduct arises out of who you really are. This is a quality that marked Job, and one that he held even in the midst of despair. In Job 1:1, he is described as blameless, upright, fearing God, and turning away from evil. That's his character. It's bad enough that Job lost his wealth. He lost his family. He was suffering physical anguish with boils all over his body, and he's scraping himself with a pot sheared. His wife told him to curse God and die. Why are you holding fast to your integrity? She thought that would be better. And then his friends began to attack, claiming his suffering must have been caused by something in him, or he wouldn't be suffering. Now understand, Job's friends are scared to death. Because if they can't find something wrong with Job, it means they're subject to the same thing. They got to somehow show they must be better than Job, or the same could happen to them. So they're afraid. So they're desperately looking for something. Job is frustrated. He even describes that as one of his defenses, my righteousness is still in it. And he describes it. You are attacking me, but I should receive kindness from my friends when I'm in despair. But you're attacking me. But he would hold fast. He said, I know my righteousness is still there. I am still doing this. I've done the works of righteousness. I continue to do this. This is my character. His hope was even that he would put on righteousness and it still clothed him. So frustrated, but he knew his own character, which is why Job still seeks out God even when he does not know why he was suffering so. Job was a man who works righteousness. Third, the godly man is truthful from the heart. You know, one of the quickest ways of understanding what actually is inside a man is listening carefully to what he says. What comes out of his mouth? Jesus talked about that in Matthew 15:18. It's out of the mouth that he reveals his heart. James 3:2 goes so far as to say this, if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man, able to bridle the whole body as well. The tongue is probably the most difficult thing for us to control, period. However, take note, David does not just say here a man who speaks truth. He says a man who speaks truth in his heart. There are plenty of people who are shallow in their speech. They say what they think others would like to hear. It happens in relationships all the time. Someone, I don't want to get in trouble, I don't want to cause waves, I'll tell them what they want to hear. We're all subject to politicians. They're become notorious for saying what they think will get votes during the campaign. Then, of course, as soon as they're elected, they do the opposite of it. There's no truth in them, at least a lot of them. Fortunately, there are some that are statesmen, not just politicians. But the man of integrity, the man of blameless conduct, speaks from out of his heart, and that is what is there, truth. He will speak the truth in love, as commanded in Ephesians 4:15, but he is going to speak the truth to those listening, whether they like it or not, because the truth is important to him, and he is going to remain steadfast in that truth. This was a quality that Hezekiah had. Hezekiah, one of the kings of Judah, he's praised in 2 Chronicles 31:20 at the end of his life. It says this, thus Hezekiah did throughout all Judah. He did what was good, right, and true before the Lord his God. Every work which he began in the service of the house of God in law and in commandment, seeking his God, he did with all his heart and prospered. So he's a good example of this. A necessary characteristic as well of those that Moses chose to be the elders of Israel, listed in Exodus 18:21. They had to have this quality of truthfulness in the heart. And actually, that's still a character quality that would fit under being above reproach that's required for elders in the church. They have to be truthful. The man then that can come to the mountain God walks in integrity, works righteousness, and the words that he has are truth from his heart. These attributes are his enduring qualities. He's also a man who avoids sin there. Look at verse 3. David lists three specific sins that are avoided. He does not slander with his tongue. He does evil to his neighbor, nor takes up a reproach against his friend. So the man who walks in integrity, who works righteousness, whose words are truth from the heart, is going to avoid using his tongue to lie, work evil against his neighbor, or join in defaming a friend. All those are strictly against Levitical law. Exodus 23 lists them. Now, first is he avoids slander. Now, the word slander here has a root meaning of to spy, to explore. In fact, it's translated that a lot. The 12 spies that went in, it's this word. They spied out the land. It means to walk about, to explore. It is said, it is really anything that is said in a malicious way to tear someone down. So it's more than just lies and half-truths. It's anything trying to tear down the character of someone else. There's a malicious intent in it. Slander is characteristic of the wicked, Psalm 50, verse 20 tells us. The true worshiper of God is going to refrain from it. Slander is often accompanied by an effort to build yourself up by comparison. In fact, that's how it's often used. Cut down the other person thinking somehow that makes you look better. Actually, it doesn't. It makes you look petty. Those who are part of the body of Christ, we are to be building each other up, not tearing each other down. Galatians 6, 1 and 2 tells us that even when our brother has a weakness, even when they have stumbled into sin, it is our duty before God to go to that brother and bear their burden. We get involved. We're helping to overcome. Whatever that weakness is, whatever the sin is, it's not just pointing out their failure. The church doesn't have spiritual police who go around and try and cite everybody and give them tickets because they did something wrong. We go along, we get inside, and we help them overcome whatever it is. Both in Matthew 7 and Paul in Galatians 6 tell us that we are to examine ourselves before we get involved in this, that we might have the proper humility before we get involved. Why? Because, let's face it, when you do a close examination of yourself, before you help somebody else who stumbled in sin, it's humbling. Because we start recognizing our own weaknesses and where those lie. And so we come with a humble attitude instead of an arrogant attitude. And that goes a long way in being able to be gracious and merciful to those that you're trying to help. So avoid slandering others. Seeking gain for yourself by tearing someone else down is a rotting foundation. In 2 Samuel 16:2 through 4, it records that Ziba actually did this to Jonathan's son Mephibosheth. He was making an effort to tear down Mephibosheth, slandering him, that he might gain control of the estate of Mephibosheth's father, Jonathan, and hence his dad, Saul, King Saul. So it was about the money, about the land. But we find in 2 Samuel 19:24 through 30 that Mephibosheth defends himself before David, but he does not act in kind. In fact, he is very humble, and he actually says, let Ziba keep it all. He is simply trusting God's going to provide for him whatever the king's decision may be. That's the kind of character that should be there. No slander. The godly man also avoids practicing any evil against his neighbor. Now, this is really stating negatively what was stated positively in verse 2, because the one who works righteousness isn't going to do the opposite of working evil. His blameless conduct is not going to allow him to work evil against his neighbor. Actions, again, demonstrate the character of a person, whether good or bad. David is an excellent example of this. Now, David had already been anointed by Samuel as the rightful king. Saul had the kingdom taken away because he would not obey the Lord. Twice, David had the opportunity to slay Saul. Once was in a cave, he's in Engedi, he's in the cave, Saul goes in, doesn't even know David and his men are there. David actually cuts off a piece of his robe. When Saul leaves, David comes out after him and holds it up, demonstrating, I could have killed you. I haven't. Because in David's mind, Saul is the Lord's anointed, and if however he's going to get gone, it's not going to be by David and his men. He would not allow himself or his men to lift up their hands against him. God will take care of it. At another point, he's going down. Saul is asleep at the camp. He grabs his spear and takes it away. Could have taken the spear and went, and that had been in. David, again, he's already anointed king. But he is not going to do evil against his neighbor, even one who's trying to kill him. And Saul was chasing David all over the place, trying to kill him. This is David's character. He was one who would avoid doing evil. David would wait for God to remove Saul. The man who can come to God's holy hill is also going to avoid taking up a reproach of a friend. Now, this is actually a lot stronger than it may appear in English. The idea of not taking up does not mean not joining in. It actually refers to not even receiving it. So it's not just I heard it and I didn't participate. It's I heard it and I sought to stop it. I won't even receive it. I won't allow it to be said in my presence. So it's not only refraining from slander, but when the slander of his friend comes up, he seeks to put a stop to it. He will call gossip what it is, and he will rebuke the one spreading it. What's the quickest way to stop gossip? Pursue truth. Actually, it is that simple. Challenge the person spreading gossip to go with you to the one that they're gossiping about and repeat to them what they said to you, face to face. It will be very rare that anybody will agree to do that. But if they do, then both sides are heard and truth can then be discerned. Gossip has destroyed friendships, families, and fellowship in church after church after church. Proverbs has a lot to say about this subject. Let me give you a few Proverbs on this subject. Proverbs 10:18. He who conceals hatred has lying lips, and he who spreads slander is a fool. 11:9. With his mouth the godless man destroys his neighbor, but through knowledge the righteous will be delivered. 16:27-28. A worthless man digs up evil, while his words are as a scorching fire. A perverse man spreads strife, and a slanderer separates intimate friends. 17:4, an evildoer listens to the wicked lips. A liar pays attention to a destructive tongue. You can see from those two, it goes both ways. It's not just the one saying it, it's the one receiving it is participating. And then 26:20-21, for lack of wood, the fire goes out, and where there is no whisperer, which is the word that's often translated as gossip, where there is no whisperer, contention quiets down. Like charcoal to hot embers and wood to fire, so is a contentious man to kindle strife. So stop gossip by refusing to receive it and rebuke the ones who spread it. Actually, it was the failure of Job's friends, which he specifically points out to them, Job 16:10 and 19:5. That was their failure. It was this. They were generating things. The sparing man should receive kindness from his friends, not reproach. They were doing that. The king Jehoshaphat of Judah also demonstrated this characteristic. There's one point in time that he has aligned himself with King Ahab of Israel, and they're going to go to battle together, and Jehoshaphat wants to know, is there a prophet of the Lord here? And they said, yeah, there's, and Ahab says, yes, there is one, but I don't like him, because he always prophesies something bad about me. That's 1 Kings 22:8. Jehoshaphat may not have even known who Micaiah was, but he knew it was wrong to approach a prophet of the Lord, and so he rebuked King Ahab for it. Let it not be said. Let's hear what the prophet has to say. The man who can come to God and truly worship him is going to refrain from speaking slander himself. He will not do evil against his neighbor. He is not going to receive gossip. In addition, he knows who deserves honor, who does not, and will be steadfast in keeping his promises. Look at verse 4. It said, "In whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord, he swears to his own hurt and does not change." The stanza of this psalm expresses the discernment that this godly man has, beginning with being able to recognize those who have a vile character and views them with contempt. Now, that's the opposite of what has become common in our own culture here. Reprobates in our culture are applauded for their sinful deeds, and others then mimic that wretchedness. They see it on TV, they see it in the movies, they hear it in a song, and they want to do it themselves. Why? Because their heart is bent toward evil. That's the opposite of the godly man. You know, as clothing and fashion keeps changing, and it has a lot over the years, those of you who have gray hair have certainly seen a lot of fashion changes over the years, haven't you? And a lot of them, for us who are, we just scratch our heads and go, why? Why would you want to do that? I'm sure parents back in the late 60s, early 70s were wondering, like, what's with this tie-dye stuff and psychedelic stuff? I said, it's ugly. And actually, it was pretty ugly. I never could figure out, where did olive green and burnt orange come in as a decor for your home? But we had it. Olive green cabinets and a burnt orange rug. It was ugly then. It's still ugly. Well, they've replaced it since then. It's a question to ask. Why are you doing what you're doing? Who are you mimicking? Because it's coming from someplace. The kid next door played with their kids, and one day he was probably, I don't know, maybe 13. He comes and he's got an earring in his ear. You're like, Jeremy, what is that about? Good question. Why are you doing that? Okay, I'm an old school guy. Ladies have earrings, and pirates have earrings. Okay, put on the patch, get the bird, go, arg me, matey, if you're going to wear an earring, right? And that's the only way I think about it. See, the Pirates of the Caribbean. He said, well, my dad has one. I said, sounds good, Jeremy. You want to be like your dad. I think that's a good thing. Do you see the difference? What are you doing? Why are you doing it? Because a lot, the mimicking is those who practice evil. And that's why they've gone to that fashion. Pretty soon it becomes commonplace. Let's be careful. Think through what you're doing and why you're doing it. This person understands who a reprobate is and doesn't want to mimic it. So this is the opposite of our culture. That's my real point here. Be willing to stand out in the crowd by being the one who's doing right. Elisha demonstrated this with King Jehoram. Now, Ahab had died, Jehoram had replaced him, and King Jehoshaphat is involved with this too. Jehoram had gotten Jehoshaphat to come with him. They're going to fight Moab, and Jehoram is concerned that he thinks Moab's going to win. And Jehoshaphat has called for Elisha to come. Here's what Elisha says to him. 2 Kings 3, 13 and 14. Now Elisha said to the king of Israel, this is King Jehoram, "What do I have to do with you? Go to the prophets of your father, the prophets of your mother." And the king of Israel said to him, "No, for the Lord has called these three kings together to give them the hand of Moab." So he already thinks he's defeated. Elisha said, "As the Lord of hosts lives, before whom I stand, were it not that I had regard the presence of of Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, I would not look at you nor see you." Now, as the story goes on, Elisha did what was right on behalf of Jehoshaphat, and he predicted a great victory, told them what to do, and they had a great victory over Moab. But he made it known his disdain for Joram's idolatry. And that's why he said, "You go to the prophets of your mother and father. You've rejected the Lord over and over and over again." There's a discernment that we need to have of who is pursuing righteousness and who is not. And those that are not, they do not get honor from us. They get our contempt because they're walking against the Lord. Now, on the opposite side is that the godly man knows how to honor those who fear the Lord. Now, this is honor that is gladly given to those with godly character, as contrasted the honor that we're required to give to those in positions of authority. That's commanded in Romans 13:7 commands us to give honor to whom honor is due and respect to whom respect is due because of their position. The fear of the Lord, we are told, is the beginning of knowledge and the beginning of wisdom. And it results in a love of righteousness within the individual and a hatred for evil. Now, the particular word here is also used of King Hezekiah in 2 Chronicles 32:33. It says, "So Hezekiah slept with his fathers. They buried him in the upper section of the tombs of the sons of David. And all Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem honored him at his death." Why? Because Hezekiah's life was marked by this fear of the Lord. He would trust God no matter what the situation was. Probably the greatest demonstration of this was the invasion by Sennacherib of Assyria. He had come sweeping down. They had already taken out Israel. He had swept along the coastal plain. He had gone down south into Lachish. He is working his way back up Jerusalem, and he surrounds Jerusalem. 185,000 in his army, and he is arrogant. He goes up to the gates and proclaims, "You all need to surrender, or I'm going to do this to you." Hezekiah tells him, "Don't say a thing." He brings the letter before the Lord, prostrates himself, dust to ashes, tears his clothes, and just presents it to the Lord. Isaiah, the prophet of this time, comes in, encourages him, "The Lord will deliver you." And the Lord did deliver him. Now, Hezekiah had done what he could to prepare for this. He knew it was coming. But how do you withstand this kind of army that had already swept everything before it? If you look at a map of that time, Assyria had conquered everything, and Jerusalem's this little island. That's it. A little island in the midst of everything that Syria has conquered. Well, the Lord did exactly what he said he would do. He delivered them. An angel of the Lord went out that night and killed 185,000 Assyrians. And Sennacherib, as he said, was like a hook in his nose, was dragged back up to Assyria. Hezekiah trusted God. And because of that, he was honored. The godly know how to honor those who are worthy of it. What is the purpose, or what is the characteristic needed for such honor? They trust the Lord. They have a fear of the Lord that generates a trust in walking with him. Do you fear the Lord? The next characteristic is that this man keeps his promises. Look at the end of verse 4. He swears to his own hurt and does not change. Now, this is not referring to somebody promising to doing something stupid, harmful to himself, and then being stubborn about it. Okay? That's not what it's saying. It's referring to someone who has thoughtfully agreed to a contract, and when the thing turns sour, he knows he's going to lose on the deal, he still upholds his end of the contract. He keeps his word. I made this promise in good faith. I will keep it even if I lose out on it. The godly man lives out Proverbs 22, verse 1. A good name is to be more desired than great riches. Favor better than silver and gold. Because personal integrity is more important to the godly man than financial gain or avoiding personal difficulty. Spurgeon said the most far-seeing trader may enter into engagements which turn out to be serious losses. But whatever else he loses, if he keeps his honor, his losses will be bearable. If that be lost, all is lost. This is not an easy one to keep, because sometimes it's going to hurt a lot to honor your word. But which is more important, your integrity or avoiding problems? Joshua is an excellent example of this particular characteristic. In Joshua 9, it records the Gibeonites, who lived near Jerusalem, sought to deceive the children of Israel because they were in among the people who were supposed to be destroyed. And they didn't want to be destroyed. We can understand that. So they make out like they're come from a far country. Joshua receives them. The elders are there with them. They look at the stuff they bring. You know, their shoes are worn out. Their clothes are torn. Their bread is stale. okay, they must have come from a far place. They don't inquire of the Lord. And so they make a covenant with them and swear to them that it will not harm them. Only a short time later, they find out, oh, these are people that were supposed to be destroyed. But here's what Joshua says. The sons of Israel did not strike them because the leaders of the congregation had sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel. And the whole congregation grumbled against the leaders. But all the leaders said to the whole congregation, we have sworn to them by the Lord, the God of Israel, and now we cannot touch them. This we will do to them, even let them live, and so that the wrath will not be upon us for the oath which we swore to them. Yeah, it wasn't what they should have done. They should have sought the Lord. But once they had given their word, once they had sworn by the Lord, once he had given this promise, they're going to keep it. And they did keep it. In fact, they kept it so much that when the Gibeonites were attacked by some of the surrounding kings, Joshua and the army went and defended them. A godly man swears to his own hurt and does not change. Integrity is crucial to us. Verse 5 shows he's a man ethical in his finances. He does not put out his money at interest, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. The ungodly are lovers of money, leading to all sorts of sin, including the practice of usury. And that is exploiting the poor by loaning them money because they're desperate and charging them high interest rates that just puts them deeper and deeper into debt. Exodus 22:25, Leviticus 25:35-38, and Deuteronomy 23:19 all expressly forbid usury. And instead it commands the poor to be sustained and loaned to without interest. It was to be an extension of God's graciousness to somebody else. And the godly will extend mercy and grace because they know what they've received from God, mercy and grace. And so as they worship God, they're going to extend that same characteristic to those around us. When Nehemiah arrived in Jerusalem, he found a mess. Nehemiah is coming from Ahasuerus, and he is the cupbearer of the king. He hears that the walls of Jerusalem are still unfinished, and he is mourning over this. The king asks him what's wrong, and he tells him what's going on. And the king allows him to go and take another group of exiles back to Jerusalem. And when he gets there, he surveys it at night, and it's a mess. The walls are all torn down. And then he starts examining what the people are like, and they're a mess. And one of the practices, the wealthy were exploiting the poor. And so the poor were becoming deeper and deeper and deeper into debt. And so Nehemiah 5 records, and most of the whole chapter, is him rebuking them for this treatment of the poor among them. In verse 10, he adds this, I, my brothers, and my servants are lending them money and grain. Please let us leave off this usury. So he rebuked those practicing it, and he himself showed the example. The early church actually went a step beyond even this in providing for those that had need, and they did it by freely sharing. In Acts 4:36-37, it records there's a fellow named Joseph of Cyprus. You know him better as Barnabas, Paul's traveling companion, the first missionary journey. It says he sold a tract of land. He brought the money. He laid it at the apostles' feet for distribution for those in need. This is what happens when God changes your heart. Because contrary to political correctness of people who act for whatever they can get, I don't care about that stuff. God provides for my needs. That's his promise, isn't it? As I seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, he says he'll provide what I need to live. So I don't need to worry about that. What I need to do is, as Paul told Timothy, is I labor so I may provide for myself, my family, and for those who have need. It's a matter of the heart. The ethics then show up. So we'll seek to meet the needs. The actual needs are there. Now remember, that's needs, not wants. Just because they have a want doesn't mean you have to meet that. But actual needs, you'll make sure that that's taken care of in a godly manner. Another way the ungodly will exploit others is to take a bribe against the innocent. They will give up their integrity and speak lies in order to gain financially or personally. Now, this would include both those paid to lie against others or a judge who accepts a bribe, which then will determine his decision. I recall reading a story some years ago of a guy kept flipping back and forth on what his decision would be depending on how much he got paid. Got paid, so he was going to go this way, and then the other group said, oh, I'll pay you more. So it was just, you had a bidding war for the bribery. Fortunately, he got tossed out. It's perversion of justice. Exodus 23:8, Proverbs 17:23 specifically state it's perversion of justice. In addition, Deuteronomy 27:25 says it brings God's curse. The godly man refuses all bribes. 1 Samuel 8:3 records that bribery was one of the reasons that Eli's sons were rejected and his descendants cursed. Recall, Eli was the high priest who raised Samuel. His sons should have taken that over, and the line continued. Instead, two of the sons were killed, and his line was cursed because his sons, among other sins, were taking bribery in their judgments. Multiple passages throughout the Old Testament, Isaiah 1, 5, Micah 3, others, they cite bribery and its resulting perversion of justice as a reason that Judah ended up going into captivity by Babylon. The godly man cannot be bribed, for truth, justice, and his own integrity are more important to him than anything that could be offered to him. The last sentence in verse 5 gives the final characteristic of this godly man. He who does these things will never be shaken. Never be shaken. Steadfast, unmovable. Now the storms of life are going to come, but the strength of his faith is going to hold because it is in his heart and has already been demonstrated outwardly by these other characteristics. He has a house, to use Jesus' illustration at the end of Matthew 7, that is built on a solid rock. And the winds, the rain, the storms, the water, it all comes against you. But because it's got this solid foundation, it stands firm. That's opposed to those whose houses are built on the shifting sands of human wisdom, and the rains come, the wind comes, the storms of life come, and it falls flat. It collapses. The Hall of Faith in Hebrews 11 lists many who stood firm in their faith in the midst of adversity. And some of the things they faced were horrible. But they stood firm in their faith. They are examples to us of what we should also do and what you can do if you walk by faith and demonstrate your trust in the Lord by keeping his commandments, keeping his word. That's why we call this the Hall of Faith. Just as an athlete is strengthened through exercise, so your faith is strengthened through the testing that comes upon it. James 2:2-4 states the testing of faith is something we should count as joyous. Recognizing that God, as he tests your faith, produces in you endurance. And that endurance would lead to maturity. Romans 5:3-8 ties facing the trials of life to perseverance, which he connects to proven character, which he connects to hope, which is grounded in the love proven when Christ died for sinners. So there's a foundation that's unshakable. Believers will have a faith that continues to increase in strength as long as their eyes are fixed on Jesus. So true worshipers of God are not going to stumble because in practicing all these things, they're walking in godliness. The foundation is firm. It won't be shaken. You'll move forward. And I pray that each person here is going to be like the man described in the psalm. Pursue that yourself and encourage those around you to do the same. Father, thank you for the blessing of your word. Thank you for these great truths. Father, for these examples too, as we look through this, all the scriptures, and just see godly men, godly women, certainly their failings are also on the pages for us to read. But we can see that we can follow those examples, that when we fail, as Proverbs says, the godly man falls 7 times and gets up. Father, we just continue to move forward because you are patient with us and long-suffering, and continue to change us into what you want us to be, conformed to the image of Christ. Father, I'd ask for each of the men here that we would demonstrate these qualities in our own lives, that we might lead our families properly. Father, or be an influence to our friends, to those around us. Be leaders in our community. Father, that others then, as they see us, might be strengthened themselves to do the same. Father, thank you for your patience, that when we have fallen, there not only are you there for us, but you send others around us to help strengthen us, to build us up, to bear that burden with us, that we might become all that you desire, someone who can approach your holy hill to dwell in your tents. In Jesus' name, amen.